We were to have an introduction. I'm not sure what happened to the introduction, but failing that, I think the best thing to do is to begin. My name is James Faulkner. Whoever printed the program gave me a promotion. I appreciate it, but I'm unfortunately still an assistant professor of philosophy at BYU. And my topic today is philosophy and theology. For Plato, the ancient quarrel was between philosophy and poetry. For many of us, it is between philosophy and theology as well. At first glance, that quarrel might seem strange. Theology is, after all, a sub-discipline of philosophy. Philosophy is thoughtful reflection in general, and theology is thoughtful reflection on the nature of God and his relation to human beings. But if we think of the quarrel in other terms, how it is a quarrel becomes more apparent. For at the root of this quarrel between two disciplines is the quarrel between reason and faith. Positions in the church, as have positions within Christianity for 1,500 years and more, tend toward one of two. On the one hand, there are those who say we have no need of philosophy. What matters is for every one of us to achieve salvation, and all we need to know for that is contained in the scriptures and the teachings of the prophets. We need only obey the commandments, partake of the prescribed ordinances, and live according to the precepts taught us by God through his representative on the earth, and we will attain salvation. We therefore stand in need of nothing else, not even philosophy. In fact, especially not philosophy, for it draws us away from the vital concerns of the gospel and the questions of salvation to concerns more trivial, and eventually it even asks us to subject the revelations of God to questioning. It thereby undermines the one thing which is required more than anything else in our lives, obedience. From this point of view, the quarrel between philosophy and theology is obvious. On the other hand, there are those with a view in which it is argued that there is no quarrel, that philosophy is essential. With St. Augustine, they say, I believe in order to understand. Reason and revelation are not incommensurable, for they are about the same world and the same truths. Therefore, philosophy and theology are not incommensurable. Revelation provides a standard for reason, but though it may tell us many things that are true in setting that standard, it also leaves much to our own initiative. Philosophy and theology, thus, are not only not incommensurable, they are essential to one another. The believer must be a philosopher, though obviously not a professional one, so his or her belief can be brought to its proper depth, so the believer can strengthen his or her faith through understanding. In spite of appearances, the quarrel between philosophy and theology is not overcome in this second position. The philosopher, according to the tradition, must be willing to question everything, to accept no standard outside that of reason. The theologian cannot do that. Though there are unbelieving supposed theologians in our day, such a thing is an unnatural beast, a thing for curiosity museums or circus sideshows. The theologian must operate from out of the realm of faith. The theologian seeks to thoughtfully reflect upon matters of fact which are hardly matter of fact, and consequently begins from a place the philosopher is unwilling to accept as a starting point. The theologian and the philosopher, therefore, may use the same tools, but in the end they remain enemies in this second point of view, too. I would like to suggest that the choice between these two views, both of which set philosophy and theology against one another, is mistaken. Theology and philosophy are at odds because both have been on the wrong track. The assumptions we've made about the nature of philosophy for at least centuries has been wrong. Therefore, the assumptions we've made about theology have been wrong as well. Let me do this by relating it to some doctrines of Mormonism, which may provide a touchstone from which to begin. One of the central tenets of Mormonism is that an apostasy occurred and a restoration was necessary. The revelation of the gospel given by Christ became distorted and was sometimes perhaps subterfuted because its inheritors no longer received revelation from God. Therefore, a new revelation of that same gospel was begun in 1820 through Joseph Smith, Jr. Without understanding this tenet, one would have great difficulty understanding much of what seems so odd about us. For it is central to understanding of such phenomena as the importance of the priesthood, the necessity of obedience to those in ecclesiastical authority, the lack of enthusiasm for ecumenism, and the practice of sending missionaries even to predominantly Christian neighborhoods. The tenet is also, I think, responsible for much of the vitality of the church from the beginning. For it says, God has spoken again, though he was absent from human affairs a long time, and he has spoken to us. Such contact with the divine through his prophet gives certainty about our lives and the requirements made of us by God. The prophet, of course, does not remove from us the necessity of personal revelation, but he does provide it with a mooring. Usually we think of this tenet of Latter-day Saint doctrine as being a description of doctrinal apostasy, but I would like to consider whether apostasy might not go beyond only the apostasy in doctrine to an apostasy in the very way we have of thinking. For if it does, our own theologizing, even when set against the standard given by modern revelation, is as infected as that of any other religious group. Let me put this in other words. We have generally been willing to recognize that an apostasy of doctrine has occurred. Whereas once it was known that God had a physical body, we believed that that knowledge was lost and had to be restored. Whereas once the ordinances of baptism and the sacrament were understood and practiced properly, that understanding and the knowledge of that practice were lost and had to be restored in these latter days. Whereas once Christians knew of the necessity of continuing revelation of Scripture, that was forgotten and had to be restored. But there may be more to the doctrinal claim that an apostasy occurred than merely the belief that certain doctrines were lost. Perhaps it is not sufficient that we restore ourselves by accepting pure doctrine. Perhaps we must also restore ourselves to an entirely different way of thinking and living, one outside the confines set for us by the tradition, the confines which have generated the conflict between philosophy and theology. If we live in such an apostasy of thinking, then in spite of our belief in the apostasy, we fall under its sway. For currently our theologizing differs from that of the tradition only in its doctrinal content, not in the questions it seeks to answer, nor in the ways in which it seeks to answer those questions. A number of philosophers in this century have argued that philosophy is indeed on the wrong track, that we have been using the wrong method of philosophizing, of thinking, and we have been asking the wrong questions, that the methods of what we call philosophy are inappropriate to thoughtful reflection. Among the philosophers who have made such an argument are people such as Ludwig Wittgenstein, John Dewey, Martin Heidegger, and most recently, notoriously, Richard Rorty. If these thinkers are right, any theology using the tools of the tradition in the way dictated by the tradition to answer the questions which arise in the tradition, regardless of its doctrinal content, will be misguided. Because I'm more familiar with the work of Martin Heidegger, let me briefly sketch his version of this critique of philosophy, and then point out some ways in which our theology may have fallen victim to the apostasy these philosophers have imputed to philosophy. According to Heidegger, the history of philosophy is a history of a mistake which was often fruitful, but more often unfortunate, and which became more and more ensconced in our ways of thinking and living as time passed. In simplest terms, the mistake is to think of being as a thing, an entity. The fundamental question for philosophy is, what do we mean when we say that something is? What do we mean by is in such sentences as, what is this? The dress is red. The number two is smaller than the number three, and God is. The history of philosophy is filled with answers to the question of being from Thales, for whom the primordial substance is water, to Descartes, for whom there are two primordial substances, mind and matter, to Hegel, for whom there's no primordial substance, but for whom the final governing substance is the absolute. Most thinkers in the history of philosophy, however, have given little time to the question of being. Instead, they have assumed they knew the answer, argued briefly for it, and proceeded from there. Descartes, for example, postulates the existence of two substances, mind and matter, differentiates between them. Matter has extensionality, in other words, measurability, and mind does not, and proceeds to build a metaphysical system on them, a system which reigns in much of our ordinary thinking today. But in all of his work, he never considers the question of what it can mean to say that there are two primordial substances. We want to ask, since they both are, they have at least that they are in common. So what do we mean when we say they are? Do we have to postulate some third thing from which they spring to account for the fact that they both are, in Descartes' case, God? Notice that not only is Descartes' system founded upon taking being to be thingly, mind and matter are the two things of which the world is composed, but the question of being that gets asked is posed in terms of still a third thing. Descartes, like the others in the history of philosophy, takes being to be a thing, and the questions generated within that history are such that they too make that assumption. To do this has excellent consequences for science. To consider primary the way of being of mere things is to lay the foundation for the investigation of things, namely science. In fact, it is to make that investigation extraordinarily possible. It provides the impetus for scientific research from Aristotle to Einstein, and few could reasonably deny the advantages given us by modern science. However, the consequences for other areas of thought are not so good. Consider one of the initiators of the modern scientific era, again Descartes. He began to take the idea of the substantial character of being more seriously than the medieval thinkers had ever dreamed. As mentioned, he postulated two entity-like substances, mind and matter, and significantly not spirit and matter. Medieval philosophers had been unable to fully conceive of being as an entity because they saw God as the creator of all things, a person, and therefore as the being. But God was, in spite of these medieval discussions of his character as a person, nonetheless, because of the tradition of Greek philosophy and its permutations through the centuries since the Greeks had thought, he was thought of in the terms of the tradition, terms which were dominated by the traditional metaphysics of things. Descartes pushed that traditional metaphysics farther than the medievals had been willing to go. He pushed metaphysics farther along a direction it had already taken. But his postulation of the two substantial entities as being had dire consequences for thought about humans, and in the end for thought about God. First of all, the focus of philosophy on matter and mind pulled it away from its medieval grounding in the belief in God and set the stage for the growth of atheism and alienation. In addition, questions about how such disparate substances as mind and matter can have anything to do with one another arose, and philosophy headed towards skepticism. How, after all, can I be sure I know anything about the world? It is out there, and I am in here, a position never before possible, but a position which generates odd questions which seem impossible of satisfactory answer. According to Heidegger, the mistake of the philosophical tradition has resulted in these odd questions. Questions much like that of the lawyer who asks, "Do you still beat your spouse?" No satisfactory answer can be given because they've been asked in the wrong way. Heidegger's proposal is to give up that old way of thinking, and he tentatively suggests that we take being to be, more or less, the totality of meanings possible in the world. Traditional philosophy concentrates on the notion of entities even when it describes humans as body and mind. It describes the mind as a peculiar kind of thing or object. Heidegger begins his study with an investigation of the way in which humans are, a descriptive investigation which does not presuppose that they are like mere objects in the world. The investigation of being as object, substance, is wrong-headed, he explains, because it does not recognize that the fact of the investigation itself reveals there to be more to being than it is found in mere entities, namely, there is human being. It is obvious that humans are not in a separate category from mere entities. We are, after all, bodily. But it is also obvious that there is something more to us than the merely bodily. There is something radically different about a dead human from a living one. And this difference is not merely that some particular characteristic has disappeared from the dead human. Thus, if we are going to speak of being, Heidegger argues, we must begin with the more complex phenomenon, being human, and proceed to the less complex, being an entity. The consequence is his discussion of being in terms of the possible meanings in the world. If we make the investigation of being human primary to our investigation of being, perhaps the most striking thing that occurs is, as we have seen, the old way of speaking about the world reveals itself to be a lawyer's question, one which cannot be answered satisfactorily. The old questions, the old terms used to give answers, the old answers, all are found to be always slightly off the mark. The questions point us in the wrong direction and cover more fundamental questions. The terms used to answer the questions divide the world into problematic categories, like subjective and objective. Categories which also cover over more fundamental understandings of the world. The answers given do not satisfy. In fact, like constant enemies of reason, the questions seem to have contradictory, but equally reasonable, and therefore equally dissatisfying answers. Consider an example. Because it is thought of being as the being of objects, and it is thought of the investigation of objects to be resolvable, the tradition has thought of the job of philosophy to pin down the list of characteristics which are essential to any particular object of thought. Thus, certainty became the quest of philosophy, and logic and mathematics, the tools for attaining certainty, became the model for philosophical investigation and knowledge. The consequence has become a consuming interest, from at least the early 17th century to the present, in epistemology. How can we know? What can we know? And know means, according to the tradition, be certain. And to be certain means to have knowledge of truths which stand independent of time, persons, or conditions. But if Heidegger is correct, the questions asked, the terms used to answer it, the answers given, and the knowledge sought are all problematic. For they may be related to genuine human problems, but they exist in such a way as to make those problems unintelligible to existing humans as opposed to mere academicians. What is needed instead is a complete rethinking of the whole subject matter, a rethinking which begins with the givens of human experience and carefully proceeds to help us understand that experience. Such a philosophy will seldom answer the traditional questions because few of those questions are genuine questions. The tradition has asked questions like, is an act right because God commands it, or is it commanded of him because it is right? How can God's foreknowledge and human free will be commensurate? Are human beings basically good or basically evil? And how is the existence of evil commensurate with God's existence? A rethinking of theology resulting from a rethinking of philosophy would begin by not asking such questions. Instead, it would ask, how can we best describe our relation to the commands of God? What does it mean that we are free? How is it that sin comes into my life? How can I best overcome it? How can I act responsibly against the evil in the world? Instead of asking questions that demand answers which wrap up the world and our experience into neat little packages and take care of it once and for all, and instead of having itching ears for such answers, we might very well come to see some resolution of various questions about the meanings of our life, especially our relation to God. We might come to resolutions which do not bring final proofs or explications, but instead explanations which satisfy our wonder without quenching it, which let us see the world, ourselves, and God as we are, explanations which give us understanding. But such a rethinking of philosophy and theology requires not only that we rethink our position on these issues, it requires primarily that we rethink the very ideas of philosophy and theology themselves. Theology, I think, becomes no longer the rational explanation of this or that doctrine, or the rational explication of the interrelation of a set of doctrines and the bringing to closure of our understanding of these, but the thoughtful reflection upon what it means to be a human being in relation to God. And this because philosophy ceases to be the rational explanation of the world and the bringing to closure of our understanding of it, and becomes instead the thoughtful reflection on what it means to be a human in the world. We might very well discover in such a rethinking that philosophy is a subdiscipline of theology rather than the reverse. Latter-day Saints interested in theologizing might well benefit from a study of some of those contemporary theologians who have worked at rethinking philosophy and theology. Contemporary hermeneutics, for example, has much to offer that might well help dissolve the old Mormon conundrum of whether God is progressing in knowledge. We have always taken the tradition to be right in setting up for us what know means, namely having mathematical certainty or some such, and therefore we have fought back and forth about this question. But Gadamer, Ricoeur, and others who have tried to work out a rethinking of the methods and problems of philosophy have often discussed the phenomenon of knowing in ways which make many of the questions traditionally asked about knowing impossible to be raised. They might well have something helpful to say about our problem, as might also some theologians like Fuchs and Eberlin. As a matter of fact, our own religious tradition has something quite useful to say about this question if we will only listen. In the first several chapters of Genesis, chapters dear to Joseph Smith and anyone who takes the temple ceremony seriously, the word know is used to describe both the attribute acquired by Adam and Eve, which makes them most like God, and non-euphemistically their marital relations. Such a possibility cannot be comprehended using the metaphysical tradition we have inherited, and I suspect that we are so steeped in that tradition that we find it difficult to take such a possibility seriously. But it is not only that we have much we might learn from those who have been trying to rethink these problems. Latter-day Saint doctrine seems to me to be particularly suited to such a project. Of course, such a rethinking, including the possible reversal of the roles of philosophy and theology, need not take the work of Heidegger or any other philosopher as a model. Heidegger, Rorty, Dewey, Wittgenstein, and others who have made the critique of the tradition have primarily been important for having made it. And this by their own admission, not because they present particular methods for going beyond the tradition. But LDS doctrine has at its core elements, I think, well suited to completely rethinking theology. Foremost among these are the doctrines associated with the divinity of humans and the humanity of God. Such a belief is so heretical from some traditional points of view that it ought well to provide us a standpoint from which to begin to rethink the entire theological tradition, a standpoint which gives up all of the old questions and formulates new ones, new ones which can come to satisfactory answers and which can focus on the meaning of being human. The possibility inherent in this belief first became apparent to me in graduate school. As two friends, one an atheist and one a Catholic, and I, sat talking about Mormonism in the graduate lounge one afternoon, both were shocked when I explained that I believe humans can literally become gods. "If you keep saying things like that," they both insisted, "you're going to get yourself excommunicated." With some persuasion, and it took me about an hour, I was finally able to persuade them that not only would I not be excommunicated for advocating such a belief, it was a commonly accepted belief among Mormons. "Then," said my Catholic friend, "you are not a believer. You are an atheist who believes that humans are perfectible and live forever." Discomfited as my Catholic friend was at my claim to be a believer, and he could make no sense of my belief in God because he tried to do so from a traditional point of view, my atheist friend was equally discomfited to hear me called an atheist. I discovered we did not fit in the tradition. It is not just that our doctrines do not agree with those of other Christians. It is that those doctrines demand a complete rethinking of what it means to be believed, of what it means to be human, of what it means to live in the world. My claim is that we have not been true to this demand made of us by the Restoration. We have not taken seriously enough the difference between the tradition and what is given us by the Restoration. We have tried to put the new wine of the Restoration into the old skins of traditional theology, but those old skins will not do. For if the tradition has made traditional philosophy and traditional theology enemies, surely it has made the Restoration an enemy to both, but not just in terms of doctrines. However, that it is an enemy to both these traditions does not make it an enemy to either if they are rethought, if they are done properly. If we take seriously the idea that philosophy is the search for wisdom, and that wisdom is not the certainty that philosophy has taken it to be, there is no way to divide the domains of philosophy and theology. There is no way to set them against each other, for they are the same thing.
My name is Sterling Van Wagenen, and I have been asked to respond to this paper. Let me say, first of all, that my response will not be necessarily an analytical one, but rather I would like to give you a series of impressions that I think flow from one another about some of the things that Jim has said. First of all, I was intrigued by the paper because it seems to me that Jim had been successful, and on one of the few papers, philosophical papers I've read, he's been successful in spending 12 pages almost without referring explicitly to the topic of the paper. When I was in Washington, D.C., some years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I went to the Freer Gallery, and there I saw an exhibit of Japanese lacquer works. And among this exhibit was a stationery box about so large that was inlaid with gold leaf and lead. And the inlay represented some tall grass that had spots of dew. The pieces of lead formed the dew on the grass. And at the edge of the box was just the bare suggestion, inlaid in gold, of a kimono. And obviously the woman who was wearing the kimono was outside the frame of the box itself. Now, those of you who have any acquaintance with Japanese painting or Japanese art of just about any description or Japanese film, will know that oftentimes what is outside the frame or outside the visible boundaries of the work of art may be as important and as definitive as what is in fact visually specifically represented. Now, I'd like to come back to that notion in just a moment, if I may. First of all, or secondly rather, Jim referred a great deal to Martin Heidegger in the paper. I would like, if I could, for a moment to get another relevant model out on the table that I think may expand some suggestions that he made and clarify a couple. And that's the model of the work of the Austrian philosopher who was transplanted to England. Jim alluded to the work of Ludwig Wittgenstein. In his early career, Wittgenstein made an attempt to rethink philosophy in these terms. He attempted to create a work that laid out a series of propositions or statements, and it was Wittgenstein's belief that these propositions, if carefully and fundamentally thought through, could in fact reflect or represent an accurate picture of the world. Now, Wittgenstein called these propositions atomistic in the sense that he saw them as the fundamental building blocks of language and by implication fundamental building blocks in terms of which we describe our experience. Now, Wittgenstein later repudiated that view of language as a kind of elemental or fundamental reflection of states of affairs that exist in the world. Let me digress a moment. Before that repudiation, however, a consequence of Wittgenstein's view was that whatever could not be described in language or in atomistic propositions or statements was of an ineffable or mystical order. It's as though one could draw a circle around all of the possible statements that refer to experience in this world, and anything that lies outside those statements could not be spoken of explicitly, but could only be shown or in some way demonstrated, but not explicitly spoken. So there's a very strong mystical element dealing with the whole areas of metaphysics, theology, art, aesthetics, that in principle were excluded in this scheme of things. Now, as I said, Wittgenstein later repudiated that view. He moved from that position to an intense interest in an ideal language that could encompass all of experience, and then from that interest moved in his later work to the conviction that, in fact, it was impossible to find and set down or articulate a fundamental set of categories or propositions or statements in terms of which the world could be defined. His view in last analysis before he died, and he taught in England at Cambridge before he died, and greatly influenced a whole generation of philosophers there, and much of that tradition has now spilled over into the United States. Wittgenstein's view in the later part of his life was that one could only proceed to describe reality or come to terms with the way in which our language describes reality on a case-by-case basis. In other words, it was a function of going item by item or context by context, that a total view was not possible or permitted. Now, Jim also alluded rather strongly to the work of Descartes and to Descartes' success in separating the notions of mind and matter, or mind and body, or mind and physical existence, or, if you'll again pardon the technical reference, subjects and objects. Jim further suggested that it was that separation of subject and object that has made possible the extraordinary advances in technology and in science that we've witnessed over the last 200 years. The importance of the comment about Wittgenstein, the importance of looking at the work of Heidegger, I think, in relationship to the tradition in philosophy, in relationship to that separation, is this. What we see in the work of these two men, Wittgenstein and Heidegger, what we see in the work of others, like Sartre, is an impulse. And it is an impulse to attempt to reintegrate or recombine subject and object, or, if you will, the external physical objective world and human beings. It's an attempt to try and get those back together again in some way that we can reasonably and profitably think about their relationship. The recent, when I say recent, within the last 35, 40 years, the recent emphasis on ordinary language in Western philosophical tradition, as well as what has often interestingly been said against the developments in ordinary language, namely developments in phenomenology, from whom Heidegger, of course, took much, as did Sartre. Those developments seem to me to represent the same impulse, namely an attempt to take philosophy out of the air, as it were, and to ground it solidly in what I suppose one could describe as common experience. What it means to experience an object, what it means to talk in ordinary ways about our experience. And again, to restate what I said a moment ago, to reintegrate human beings with the world that they had so long been living, in a sense, alienated from. Now, all of that may seem, and I ask your pardon for seeming to be a bit technical about all of that, but the impulse, I think, felt by men such as Wittgenstein and Heidegger is an impulse that not only was felt by the prophet Joseph Smith, but that, as Jim suggested, had rather extraordinary consequences for the development of Mormon theology, especially in the 19th century, much less so since, I suppose, the death of B.H. Roberts. For example, in the 93rd section of the Mormon Doctrine and Covenants, Joseph Smith says, "For man is spirit, the elements are eternal, and spirit and element inseparably connected receive a fullness of joy." There is a suggestion there, a very strong one, that there is, in fact, a continuum of existence between what is natural and what is supernatural. A continuum that, in many ways, has more in common with Eastern traditions in philosophy than with Western traditions. May I make another allusion to a Japanese work of art? There is a film entitled Ugetsu Monogatari, translated, I guess, roughly, Tales of the Pale and Silvery Moon. It was made in the mid-50s by an extraordinary Japanese director named Kenji Mizoguchi. The film is about, put simply, it's about a potter, an artisan, who attempts to exploit a condition of civil war, which existed in Japan at that time, to get his pots to a city and sell them for a very high profit. In the course of doing that, he leaves his wife and child on their own, and his wife and child, attempting to find him, are attacked on a mountain pass, and the wife is killed by a mercenary, by a soldier. She's speared to death, and the boy runs off. After a series of interesting adventures, this potter attempts to return home to his village. And in doing so, he comes on the village, which is totally decimated, has been wiped out by the warring factions of the various samurai lords. And, however, he comes on his own house, and we see the house from his point of view. And as he approaches the house, we see that the house, the basic structure of his house, though damaged, is still standing. And as he comes to the house, the camera then cuts to the inside of the home. And we see instantly, we see him through a window on the outside. And he begins to walk from the right of the screen to the left of the screen on the outside of the house, and the camera tracks with him on the inside of the home. And as the camera tracks, we see that the hearth, the fireplace, is cold. We see that the house is in disarray. And he, as he walks, he calls out the name of his wife and his son. And it's very important, in a continuous shot, the camera moves with him from right to left and then stops as he reaches the extreme end of the house. And we see him again through another window. He turns and then walks back again, and the camera follows him back. However, as the camera moves back with the potter, we see that, again, this is the same camera shot. There have been no cuts. We see that the house has been restored. A fire has been lit in the fireplace. And sitting by the fire is, in fact, his wife, whom we know to be dead. And the camera pans back fully, and the door opens, and he enters the home for a reunion with his dead wife. Now, visually, that's an extraordinary moment, because what the artist, what the filmmaker has succeeded in doing is uniting form and content in such a way that there is no division metaphysically between this world and the other world, or between life and death, or nature and supernature. They're all of a piece. And the implication, I think, from that illustration is rather profoundly demonstrated again in Jim's allusion to the humanity of God and the divinity of man. Mormons, I think, perceive, or hopefully perceive, that there is a continuum, an unbroken line, that stretches from life before this one, through this one, and into a life after this one. But also an unbroken line between spirit and matter, between ourselves and our relationship with the external world, which had been severed so magnificently by traditional Western philosophy. Now, I'm getting on just about finished, and then I think we'll let Jim rebut if he chooses to, and then open it for questions. Now comes what I think is the shaky ground. By shaky, I mean what I'm about to say refers more to what lies outside the frame of Jim's paper than what is actually, in fact, present within its body. Heidegger was attributed his rethinking of the philosophical tradition to what he called his own astonishment at the nature of being. His, in some cases, perverse but intense fascination with the physicality, the quiddity, if you will, of what it means to be or to exist. Coleridge once said that all philosophy begins in wonder. There is a hymn, a Christian hymn, that we often sing in the Mormon church, "I stand all amazed at the love Jesus offers me." There is a sense in which I suspect it is impossible to divide what Jim suggests as an agenda for Mormon thinkers, namely the rethinking of the theological and philosophical tradition. There's a sense in which it's impossible to divide that from Heidegger's sense of astonishment, Coleridge's sense of wonder, Sartre's term engagement, littérature engagée, the literature of engagement, with the process of coming up against life, whatever that may mean. By implication, and I think by example, Joseph Smith demonstrated far better than any successive figure in Mormon life, with, again, the possible exception of someone like B.H. Roberts, what it was to be fully engaged in the act of living, and at the same time fully engaged in the act of thinking and rethinking philosophical and theological premises. Now, I can do no more than allude to that process, and I emphasize the word process. It seems to me it's not possible in this setting, perhaps not in an academic setting at all, for theology, either LDS theology or the Western tradition, to be rethought with any integrity, separated, as it were, abstracted, as it were, from this process that seemed to mean so much to people like Heidegger and Sartre. I have a suspicion that one of the reasons Mormons are given institutionally the gift of the Holy Ghost has to do with precisely that point, that there is an intimate relationship between knowledge and action that cannot be severed. And to the extent that it is severed, we tend to find a sentimental, anemic, and in many cases, irrelevant theology. And my suspicion is, perhaps pushing Jim a little further than he would want to go, that there may be a very real sense in which our thinking about God and our activities as Mormons, in some sense, may need a reformation. Let me give you one final example, if I may. This is from Eliot, from the Four Quartets. And Eliot may teach us this point somewhat accurately by indirection. This is from Bert Norton. Eliot says, "At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor toward, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point." And then skipping a bit, "There would be no dance, and there is only the dance. Time past and time future allow but a little consciousness. To be conscious is not to be in time, but only in time can the moment in the rose garden, the moment in the arbor where the rain beat, the moment in the drafty church at Smokefall be remembered, involved with past and future. Only through time is time conquered."
Yes.
Last year I gave a paper on Mormon ethics and the grounds of it, and I like to think that my concern with those issues comes from sorts of personal concerns that are involved in your way of wanting to phrase the question, how do I relate to the commandments of God? In writing the paper, I found myself ending up discussing the question of whether God commands it because it's right, or is right because God commands it. Okay? And that happened for a few reasons, as far as I can figure out in 10 seconds I spent thinking about it now. Either because discussing that question that I really care about, you have to get specific and you have to address certain ways that the world gets, you have to cast the world in ways that make it make sense, and you have to get specific, you have to atomize things in ways that you're all uncomfortable with. Or else it happens because I was taught to do philosophy at Stanford. And I want to know that, I mean, you're alleging that's the second.
I'm alleging it's both.
Okay. I want to know something about
I'm alleging that you were taught to do philosophy that way at Stanford because of the first one.
Okay. Well, the first one is really the problem. That you almost have to think about those questions. Well, if I want to know, if you have to phrase the question in a new way, okay, how do I relate to God's commandments? How are you going to avoid thinking about it the old way?
That's the reason that I said that I think primarily what has to be done first is not a rethinking of the doctrines or the questions. It has to be a rethinking of what does it mean to be doing this. And frankly, when I tried to, when I gave examples, it was easy for me to come up with examples of the questions, which it seems to me we are always battling back and forth over. When I tried to give examples of what an alternative question might be, I felt very weak, and I'm not confident that my alternative questions are really good alternative questions. I don't feel like I have somehow made this step over beyond the tradition, so I'm not quite sure what to say. But I don't think that it's a matter of thinking about the question and saying, now, let's see, this is the question we've been asking. What can we replace it with? Because it seems to me if what we do instead is replace that activity with another activity, then the new questions will just be there and we won't ask those old questions at all. I mean, they won't come up.
Sherman sort of pointed out what he thinks that activity is, and I had to point at it.
Well, it's difficult to point at, even. It seems to me that the answer is in this lack of a distinction between theory and practice. I find very objectionable two things. One of them, I do have one objection to part of what Sterling said, is it seems to me that when he says, well, I'm not sure this can be an academic discipline, my reply to that is, well, then all we need to do is rethink what academics is. I mean, I'm not opposed to throwing out the university as it's presently constituted at all. As long as I keep my job, all right. So I would agree that it certainly is not something that can be done abstractly. On the other hand, most people who say, well, there's no distinction between theory and practice, want to go the other direction and say, that means simply just, as a friend of mine recently said, read the scriptures and pray about it, and it'll all be okay. Don't ever worry. And I don't think that either of those alternatives is the correct alternative. It lies somewhere in between where, I must say, my own experience in the church is that it is there is no division between the meaningful participation in the community of the church and my thinking about the church. I haven't seen any way of saying, well, the thinking about it is what I do here and the meaningful participation is there. And it's something like that that was going to have to occur. But I, as I say, I'm not. If I were there, I would feel a lot better about it. But then I couldn't talk to you anyway. So.
And I would add to that, the temptation to fall into a mode of analysis is almost irresistible. In fact, it is irresistible for all of us, which is why I alluded to a piece of film and a piece of poetry and an object of art, because it seems to me that those kinds of experiences have as much to do with the business of theology and ultimately philosophy, and I underscore the word experiences, have as much to do with that business as the business of analysis, which is so wholly a function of a Western way of approaching the traditional subject-object division. So you really get into an opposition. You know, on the one hand, between an inclination to set out things in some sort of rational order, which makes it easy for us to discuss them, as opposed to, if again, you'll forgive a trendy word, a more holistic approach to that process, whatever that is.
I also think, though, and this is back to what Sterling was saying about experience, it seems to me that that the division that occurs is an artificial one. It's there, and we feel it, and we've learned it, and we grow up with it. But since it is an artificial one, it is one that can be overcome, this division between thinking and acting. But as a consequence of the division, we've developed a very odd kind of thinking Not that we ought not to do mathematical and logical thinking. I've written a logic textbook, and I teach logic, and I think that it's a good discipline. But I don't think that that is the epitome of thought. Frankly, I think that the Four Quartets is a better example of human thought than any syllogism in my book. I think that that might be a commonplace, and yet when we often begin to talk about what it means to think, we take the syllogism to be much more somehow what it is to think than it is to write the poem. And I would not want to separate those either. I wouldn't want to have a thought that what I'm advocating is the abandonment of technology, science, or logic, because that is simply the mirror image of the bad way of thinking. No, I would want to suggest that that's the case, because if I were to suggest that's the case, quite frankly, that would fly in the face of a great deal of thinking that's been done. What I'd want to suggest, though, is the fact that we find the results of that traditional way of thinking about those things unsatisfying, that they become antinomies of reason, is to suggest that there's a problem at the base there.